This is the Medical Professional Liability Panel. Here we have four companies that we cover here at Oppenheimer, ProAssurance, FIPIC, AP Capital, and American Physician Services Group. And we have Vic, President of ProAssurance here, John Byers, CEO of FIPIC, Frank Freund is the CFO of AP Capital, and Tim LaFrey is the CEO of American Physician Services Group. So what I'd like to do is to start out by giving everyone a chance to talk for a few moments about their company, and then we'll go ahead and get started with questions. I'll start with Vic.
Thank you. I'm president of ProAssurance Corporation. We're based in Birmingham, Alabama, but we're a national writer on the medical professional liability line. Our company is a consolidation of 19 provider-started companies or books of business. As the insurance industry, as the medical professional liability sector is maturing, we've definitely been, see ourselves as continuing to be a consolidator, putting companies together, finding the synergies related to that. Some of those are cost-wise, but a lot of them are in terms of distribution platforms, being able to service business on a local and regional basis in states far from the headquarters. We're the largest of the independently traded medical professional specialists. We insure about 62,000 insureds generally, of which 54,000 are healthcare providers. And those range from hospitals to physicians to podiatric physicians to chiropractors, and most recently to ancillary healthcare providers, which we see as a definite growth area in this sector. In terms of some of the numbers, premium for our organization last year, 2009, was just north of $550 million with $4.6 billion in assets. And I know Mike will have some questions on portfolios, and we have a portfolio of about $3.9 billion at the present time. The organization's ranked A by Best and the Fitch organization. We're on the Ward's 50 list of best property and casualty insurance companies, and we were pleased last year to get recognized as the best mid-sized employer by Business Insurance Magazine. So we as we try to manage the organization, we have definitely a national scope, although our premium is concentrated in the Midwest and the Southeast. But we do look at the country as a whole, looking at trends, looking at what's going on for the long term of this business.
Do you want us to go into any?
No, that's great. Okay. That's great. I'd like to give to next to John, please, talk a little bit about FIPIC.
Okay, thank you. I'm the president and CEO of FIPIC. Our organization is, and really for a number of years has been, the market leader for medical professional liability insurance in the state of Florida, which is one of the largest Med-Mal markets in the U.S. Also, by virtue of our acquisition last November of a Texas Med-Mal rider, we're the fourth largest rider in the Texas market, which is also a top 10 market. We have significant market positions in several other markets, and we currently write in a total of 13 states. We focus exclusively on the practitioner market, on physicians, dentists, other healthcare professionals. We do not underwrite hospitals or nursing homes or really any other lines other than the practitioner lines that I described. Our business strategy is to target markets where we have or can obtain substantial expertise and market knowledge, which we think are critical for sustainable success in this line of business. Our organization enjoys very strong customer loyalty. Our retention rate for existing policyholders is quite high. We have very strong ties to the medical community as well as to the agent community. Really, our focus, and I guess the basic tenet of our business strategy, is just our focus on the core disciplines and our core competencies, being disciplined with our underwriting, being reasoned with our pricing, aggressive but effective with our claims handling, and really just an ongoing and consistent focus on our strategies and our systems and our processes to assure that we're efficiently operated and that we're effectively monitoring and adjusting to evolving market conditions. In terms of growth opportunities, We have grown our book of business over the last year or so, both in our core markets and in selected new markets, and we'll continue to look to do that. Again, we've seen good growth in our established Florida market, Georgia, Arkansas, and our more recent Texas market. We're growing some, and we've recently gone into South Carolina. We'll continue to look for that, as I said, both internally, and we'll continue to assess acquisition and other opportunities that we see that might make sense for us and our shareholders. All in, we are comfortable with where things stand, and I think we continue to be well-positioned for what the future may bring.
Great. Thank you, John. And I'll turn it next to Frank from AP Capital. Frank?
Hi, good morning, everyone. I'm Frank Prine, the CFO of AP Capital, and Kevin expresses regrets for not being able to be here today. But American Physicians is based in East Lansing, Michigan. We've been a public company since 2000. Our footprint is primarily in the upper Midwest, with Michigan, Ohio, and Illinois being our largest states. We also are the leading writer in New Mexico, which came to us in a statutory merger back in the late 90s. And so in all of our markets, we have a considerable experience. And so our focus has been on really cultivating those markets, developing great both independent and captive agency relationships. We write about 113 million in premiums, about $1 billion in assets. Again, our growth strategy has been, again, focusing on the existing markets where we feel like we have a great knowledge of the markets, good understanding of the courts and jurisdictions. We're currently rated A minus by AM Best, and we're very much a shareholder focused company. We've been active with our share repurchases as we've had excess capacity. But we remain watchful for any growth opportunities or M&A opportunities.
Frank, and then I'll turn over to Tim from AMP.
Yeah, I'm president of American Physician Service Group, the other American Physicians here, and we are a writer primarily in Texas, 35-year-old company. We are have been publicly traded since 1983. We have about 6,700. Policyholders, 90% of those in Texas, and the rest in the adjoining states, Arkansas and Oklahoma. We are A-minus rated by Best also. As you may know, Texas has some of the strongest tort reform in the country, and we focus on the surgical specialties and the large physician practice groups. That's sort of our niche. We have benefited a great deal from the growth of those groups, as the Texas market has become one of the largest growing markets since 2003, when we had our tort reform. So we've enjoyed a 20% average annual headcount growth since 2003, and have been able to return an average 36% return on our stock price since 2000. So we've had a real lift from the regulatory change in our core state.
Great. Okay, so I'll turn to Vic now, just to start with some questions. Again, folks on the web or folks in the room, if you have a question, please don't be bashful. Otherwise, I'll just railroad this whole session and ask a bunch of questions. So, like I did the last one. Okay, so Vic, do me a favor, and if you could talk a little bit about how you think about healthcare reform. You know, and what it means, what it could potentially mean for the industry, for ProSurance in particular. I realize there are a lot of unknowns, but if you could just kind of scope out your thoughts around healthcare reform as it could potentially impact this industry.
Sure, thanks, Mike. And probably better said, health insurance reform. For those of you who read through the summaries of the bill, has anybody actually read through the bill? No. Okay. It really deals with the insurance mechanisms for healthcare, but it does have some potential impact on our organizations. I think the easy answer is in the short run, there is nothing directly that impacts what we do. All of these four companies are members of the Physician Insurers Association of America. Our roots are all in physician-started companies. We're very interested in tort reform, how those mechanisms work. There's nothing in the bill other than some demonstration projects, which have almost no legs on them. And to show you where the lobbying clout was in Washington, the demonstration projects have two caveats with them. The plaintiff can opt out of a demonstration project at any time, and you cannot impact attorney's fees. So get the lay of the land. But the longer term, though, I would suggest, and our organization is looking at it, is suggesting that it's really part of the evolution of health care, that it will put probably more pressure on practicing physicians, probably mitigate towards larger groups, more hospital involvement in the process. We're seeing that a lot now, even before health care comes in. And so as we think about it in our organization, we think about both the what we call upmarket and downmarket, where healthcare in the long term will probably be part of having larger group practices or larger hospital-based practices and a greater use of ancillary healthcare providers. We picked up a company last year that does ancillary, so we're now in that business. And we historically have been a hospital provider. It's about 15% of our overall business. Not a major part of our business, but we've been part of that. And we're definitely looking at those that, as we move forward, we have to become better at, grow our capabilities in, so that we can be playing in that market. The individual market, in our view, will certainly be there in the long term, but whether the size of the individual market will be the same is a big question mark.
Great. And, I mean, I guess just to clarify a little bit, when I talk about the reform, I'm talking specifically about a group of previously uninsured people that will be insured and kind of what that could mean for your exposure, your doctor's exposures, and you know, just demographic trends, et cetera. More the second order effect. I'm sorry.
Sure. No, that's fine. You know, I had my thought process in place, and you threw me a softball. It's really interesting when you think about it. We think about 30 or 40 million without health care insurance or are now going to have health care insurance. So, you know, we all get used to numbers and what do those numbers mean. I mean, I live in the state of Alabama. That's 7 new Alabamas coming online. That's like 3 New Jerseys coming online. It's massive. And when you look and say, where are these doctors going to be that are going to serve these populations? We are modestly expanding medical schools. You know, and you might get 200 or 300 out of a new medical school in the next 5 years. I mean, there's really been no preparation. So I think the big question mark, and we all have the same question, I don't think anybody has the answers, is what will be the impact on the practicing doctor and on their patient satisfaction as a result of a much more accessible influx. People argue effectively that folks get health care now, so maybe in the overall, you know, from the aggregate, it's not going to change the dynamics a lot, but it will hopefully shift people from the emergency rooms back to individual physician practices. And I mean, we look around and say, where are these physicians going to come from? So I think you're going to have a lot more demand on the office practitioners, on the everyday procedures that go on, and how that is played out through the physicians will ultimately impact our business. But, it's an unknown. I mean, patients, it's easy to say, if patients are satisfied with their treatment and their rapport with the physicians, one has less suits, and if it's the opposite, they have more suits. And, you know, it's not, and everybody's nodding their heads. You know, we can't quantify it more than that, but I would suggest that's ultimately the issue.
Great, thanks. And John, if you want to comment on that, I mean, you have anything to add, or we can move on?
No, I mean, I agree with what Vic said. I think that the question of how it will affect bringing all these people online, will that put greater pressures on the primary care part of the market? First of all, we don't have enough primary care physicians to handle it. We've got to grow that market. Will it mean more patients? Will it mean more pressures on them? And will that increase claims trends? I mean, that is the question. If they see more patients and spend less time, you would logically expect that to move claims trends up. But I think we'll have to wait and see, as Vic said. I don't think that's a given. The other thing, and I think Vic touched on this as well, is that we're probably going to see the trend that's already happening of doctors moving to larger group practices and perhaps becoming hospital-based and adjusting our business models as we need to for that. Our organization is accustomed to riding large groups. We've done it for a long time. We also have initiatives in place to provide management services to alternative arrangements, self-insured, and other alternative arrangements. And again, that's been measured growth, and it's really just an adjunct to what we do. But you may see that assume a greater focus in our line of business. I think how hospitals, for example, how doctors group together will probably vary by region. But in some instances, when the hospital is involved, they may choose to self-insure. They need larger limits. I think we all have to adjust to that. And that's something that we are focusing on and really have been focusing on for 2 or 3 years in terms of our are trying to be flexible and provide whatever services they need in the medical professional liability line.
And I mean, I guess given now the way that all of you monitor your business, I mean, as these new, you know, this new group comes online, if that impacts your doctors, will you see that in whether it's number of patients that your doctors are seeing, number of doctors in practices? Like, will you see that trend manifest early through your monitoring, or is that...
You'll see some of it. I just, as a fact in here, though, the main, the new insurance availability coming online is really a 2013 event.
Correct, sure.
So it's going to be a while before
sure.
that starts to show itself in the system. I think through our risk, probably speaking for everybody, through the risk management efforts, you see some of it, but the data does lag in this business, so the actual impacts will lag.
Yeah, I mean, same here. We do substantial risk management, particularly with large groups, as you would expect. So we'll start seeing some, I guess, leading indicator type things of are our doctors under more pressure. But again, we all today, which is very unlike probably 10 or 15 years ago, we very much monitor our business and our claims trends, really all the way up to the top levels of the organization. So, and we write primarily claims-made products. So I think... we will see it, as Vic said, inevitably there will be some lag in it, but we very much monitor it. We also put a conservatism and trends into our reserving and our pricing.
John, Frank, would you like to comment on?
Well, yeah, I would just echo like Vic and John were saying. I think the key is preparing now for the, again, physicians to move into larger groups and being hospital-based. And like those two, we've been preparing having the systems and the people who can underwrite the larger groups, provide the services to the hospital-based plans, I think being flexible and adaptive there are really the keys.
Tim, do you have any?
No, I agree with everything that's been said. The only thing I would mention is I'm also on a large hospital system board. Is the thoughts in the hospital part of the industry is that you know. There's going to be a lot of consolidation in the hospital systems also. And so the question is, are the hospitals going to be willing to employ or able to employ all of these docs? Most of the hospitals in the U.S. are nonprofit, and the perception is, the anticipation is that those will face the largest consolidation pressure because of their capitalization issues. So I think it's going to be a real open question. I think you may end up with some large national physician groups as a result of this at some point, you know, 10 years, 5 years, 10 years down the line.
Great. Great, thanks. Okay, so and then to John, if I could. Can you just talk about your, you know, we talked a little bit about capital, touched on it in the last panel. I expect that this will be a prominent theme throughout the day today. You've been both active on the M&A side as well as in the buyback arena. Can you just kind of talk about how you think about capital deployment, management, and allocation?
Certainly. First of all, I mean, our first and foremost is a very volatile line of business, and I think, again, I'm sure I speak for all of us here, maintaining substantial financial strength is an absolute imperative in this line of business. So we do focus on maintaining substantial financial strength. In terms of our allocation of capital, certainly writing good medical professional liability business is our highest and best use of our capital and the one that is our initial focus always. We have, it's been soft market conditions for a couple of years, but we have continued to hold good retention and to have prudent growth in our policyholder base, both internally and through some acquisitions as well. So that will always be the first thing that we look to is our ability to write good business if at all possible. Beyond that, we'll use our capital to support other initiatives such as the management services initiative that I described, which is not very capital intensive, but in some circumstances can require some capital. We'll look at it for other opportunities, acquisitions, or other opportunities that we might have out in the market. We'll certainly take that into account in our capital position. At the end of the day, having done all of that, we look at our capital position, we look at our outlook, and we look at the market conditions. If it all lines up and we have excess capital, we'll look to return that to the shareholders. And to date, I think as with everybody here, we've done that through share repurchases.
Great. Great. And just, I mean, because it's somewhat of a timely topic with the tax law, dividends, I mean, can you just talk briefly about where you think about or how you think about dividends in the priority or scheme of...
Well, we'll look to it from time to time. Again, with us and most really the sector over the last few years trading below book value, we've thought and I think it's been borne out, the best equity investment we can make is repurchasing our own shares. So that's worked out quite well for us. And so to date, that's been it. But we're not adverse to dividends. I know some of the companies here pay dividends. We'll look to it. The question becomes to us, if it's going to be a periodic dividend, it probably needs to be relatively modest because at some point we'll want that capital to write new business. And so we look at those sorts of things. But, again, in our assessment, as we've looked at it for our shareholders today, share repurchases have made the most sense. So we would obviously, if dividends, if that moved on the other side of the equation, we could see where dividends might make more sense.
Frank, could you talk a little bit about the same topic, capital management?
Sure. Well, we follow a very similar strategy with, again, the first key is maintaining sufficient capital at the insurance company level to execute the business strategy and grow when profitable opportunities present themselves. And then we do move the excess to our holding company, where our focus there is maintaining flexibility and doing what's going to be best for the shareholders. And over the last several years, that's been buying back shares, paying that modest dividend that you mentioned, retiring debt when that makes sense. So again, and then the other thing we've done, too, is reduced our reinsurance purchases, too. Again, we have the capital to take that risk on. But all of those approaches have been, again, very, very flexible because we look at, again, what's going on in really both marketplaces, the businesses we write and then the market for our stock. So, and we dovetail that then with our investment strategy of, maintaining liquidity and flexibility there, too.
FIPIC and AP Capital have had pretty similar buyback profiles over the last couple of years, I think, and tell me if I'm wrong, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40, you bought back somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40% of your companies since the end of 08. Does that sound about right?
Ours is more like since the end of 05, but that's the number, the percentage is right, but over a bit of a longer period.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And then, FIPIC stock trading below book, AP Capital trading above book. Can you talk about... maybe Frank first, can you talk a little bit about how you think about returning capital to shareholders at the current valuation and then talk maybe about your dividend as an option as well?
Sure. If I think I understand the question right. We try to look at what we think is the underlying franchise value of the company. And again, that can or can't be reflected in the market price of the shares. And again, where we think it's an attractive buy, our primary focus has been the buying back of shares. And as John mentioned, that seems to be the preference of the shareholders and the best way to return value to them. With dividends, we've taken the approach of, again, the periodic. We play a quarterly amount. It is a modest amount, so... we've been paying it kind of indefinitely, but it's not something, again, where we can maintain the flexibility. And if the the PL market changes and there's opportunities to grow and we can use the capital there, we have the flexibility to move off of that strategy.
Okay. And then John, that's great. And then, John, I mean, just in terms of you had mentioned buying back stock below book value, can you talk about how your approach may change if you get to the point where your stock is trading at a premium to book, is that where you would consider a dividend more?
Right. Well, certainly just as a general principle to us, the dividend would look relatively more attractive than it does today at that level. The stock repurchases become a tougher issue. It depends on your assessment of the franchise value and what you can do for the shareholders going forward. So I'm not suggesting we would never do repurchases at above book value. It's just... I guess to some extent a luxury. At below book value, it's a slam dunk. It's an easy issue. We would assess it at the time, and it depends on our capital needs. Really, what makes sense for our shareholders.
Right. Okay. And then, for Tim and Vic, I mean, can you talk about your same issue, same topic, capital management. You've been less frequent buyers of your stock in recent years than the other two companies. And just kind of talk about how you think about capital management and deployment.
Sure. And, you know, we've paid dividends for 7 years now, so we're, you know, not sure what's going to happen to the tax laws this year. So we'll be looking at whether we it makes sense to continue to pay dividends after this year, or even possibly pay a, you know, sort of a final dividend later this year if that looks like what's going to, like the tax benefit of getting dividends is going to go away. But we've been pretty committed to the dividend approach. We buy back our shares almost exclusively below book value, or what we think book value will be at the end of the current quarter. So we're pretty disciplined at staying under book value. Our 10b5-1 plan that we use during the blackout periods locks us into that as well. So, you know, that we have an issue with, you know, concerns about how much float we have out there, and, you know, and that sort of thing. So buying back shares sort of works against us on that issue. So we're, you know, again, committed to buying back shares. We just increased our buyback so that we could do that, because our shares have been trading below book value. But I would not anticipate us to be aggressive repurchasers above book value.
And then in terms of M&A activity, can you kind of just talk about your position there, either as, you know, an acquirer or an acquiree? And, you know, if you were on the acquirer side, would you look exclusively in your home state of Texas or the states where you currently write business?
Well, yeah, we would probably – well, we know everybody that's in our state, and so we probably would not be looking at those companies. There's really only one private company there now that might be interesting, and it's one that based on what we know about it, we wouldn't pursue. But we'd like to see geographic expansion, and if there was an M&A opportunity in another state, that would actually be more attractive to us than one in our current state, as long as it had a good management team and a good track record and sound fundamentals. Our experience, and I think everybody's experience here, is that it's a very tough M&A market now. There's not a lot of sellers, and there's a lot of buyers, and so it's been more challenging than we actually thought it would be to get an acquisition. Like everybody else in the public arena, you know, we have a fiduciary duty to our shareholders to consider any opportunities that might be presented to us as an acquiree. I can tell you that while we get, you know, some soft conversations about that, the sort of multiples that you've seen in the market for some of these acquisitions in the insurance industry have not been offered to us. And so, you know, I don't know if we should take that personally or not, but we will listen to anybody's approach, we are an attractive target because of our focus in Texas, and it's probably the best state to be in right now. We just have to be judicious about that and make sure that, you know, if we're gonna do a transaction, that we do a transaction that is really better for our shareholders than what we can achieve in the short run.
Great. Thanks. And then, Vic, if you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Sure. Let me go back to the capital, then work to M&A. Balance is the key in everything we think about at ProAssurance. We start from the premise that we're an insurance organization, so having a very strong balance sheet is important to our insureds, hopefully important to the market, and certainly important to our future. In the insurance business, all you have is capital. You don't have factories or fleets of planes or oil rigs. All you have is capital that allows you to grow your business. So we always are trying to maintain a very strong capital base that will allow us to grow the business when opportunities arise, because we have grown the business primarily through mergers and acquisitions. Going from there, there are times when stock repurchases make great sense. We've looked at dividends. We've actually talked to our major shareholders over time, and the preference that they've expressed to us has always been more on the share repurchase side, although, you know, that's not 100% opinion. So we have been active in the share market. Percentage-wise, I'm not sure who leads the pack, but we've spent a lot of dollars in terms of share repurchases, and we certainly intend to continue to do so. But within the backdrop, that our focus is to maintain a very strong capital base that allows us to meet our insurance obligations, as anybody in the insurance business wants to do, but be in position to do transactions when they arise. You know, the M&A market is episodic. One has to be patient. Opportunities arise, and you have to be able to
seize those opportunities and go forward. We've tried to build a record of being a good company to merge into. Our model is such that the companies that have come into our organization have remained active in their local geography, and that's the way we provide local services to our insureds, but it allows us to consolidate the capital base, the investments, the things we can do best centrally. It's a model that's worked well for us. We were pleased over the last year to bring a little different organization in, the Podiatry Insurance Company of America, which was a mutual, brought it in to serve a little different piece of the healthcare community. But again, as we look at it all, there's no one right answer. It's just balancing all those factors, and that's what we feel the shareholders pay us for as managers.
Right, and just in terms of your rating, I mean, you were recently upgraded to A by AM Best. I mean, how important is an A rating to you versus an A minus rating in terms of managing your capital?
It was about time that Best gave us an A, but in terms of managing to it, we would look at that if we were on the margins and make some judgment as to whether it was critical. I think in doing this line of business, at least for the independent physicians, an A is nice to have, but it probably is not essential. But as we look to do other businesses, maybe get into other providers that are sold more through programs or those sorts of things, not that we're in the program business, but as you look at other distribution mechanisms that are controlled by the distributors, an A becomes important there. So it's more a future-looking issue than a current issue.
Great. Thank you. John, I can't remember. Did I already hit you with this one, or my mind is not there?
Which one?
Did you ask this question about capital? I think we started with you, correct?
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Just make sure.
Same answer as Vic.
Okay. And then, all right. So halfway into the panel now, I'm going to ask my first question about rate. Can you talk about, you know, where you see the reserve position for the industry overall, where loss trends, frequency trends are now, your own rate filings in recent periods, and, you know, just generally speaking, do you think that you could see rate improvement with the overall industry still potentially in a redundant position, even if frequency trends start to improve? And I'll start with one, two. Frank, is that right? Okay.
I'll
get this down by like a fourth panel. Sorry.
That's great. I think our results and statistics would mirror the industry and the rest of the sector as far as our rates have come down over the last 2, 3, 4 years, typically in single digits. And the reserves have been developing favorably for several years. Frequency has been coming down. It seems now it's like leveling off, and severity has been fairly well behaved with kind of a general gentle trend upward. My sense is that the industry is being pretty disciplined this time around. I think in the past you had a little bit more volatility as far as rates. I think people are sticking to their underwriting discipline and pricing and focusing on retention. I think everyone has outstanding retention rates. And so I think that has kind of helped, maintain a little bit more of an even keel. The other thing I've noticed this time, too, is most everybody, again, on the panel are in well-established markets. They know them. They know the courts and jurisdictions. And so you're not having to deal with a lot of new business that you've written in a new market. So to me, there's a lot more stability. So as far as where rates will go, to me, it just seems like it's going to stay a little, I don't know if soft's the right word, but at least a little squishy for a while. But I do see companies maintaining discipline on both the rating and the reserving. And so I think the reserves will remain strong.
Great. Tim?
Yeah, we've been billing all our renewals flat. We're in our third year now. We have historically in Texas, where we're not regulated on rates and forms, been one of the more disciplined writers in the state in terms of pricing. And so we were the last to take our rates down after tort reform and the first to start billing flat. So that's just consistent with our culture. I think, you know, we had an overall rate decrease on renewing business at 2% last year. I think we're going to see a continuing leveling of rates, and I think maybe at least in our states we might see rates increase 24 months from now, 2 years, start seeing rates go back the other way.
claims trends in our state continue to be very favorable. So it is a challenge to justify that, you know, from a marketing perspective. But I think there's enough of a disconnect between the historical basis on which you reserve and the future basis on which you price to separate the reserve redundancies from the pricing methodologies. And so, you know, we believe that things can't get much better, and we see them getting worse in other parts of the country. And so we think it's time for – and we've talked to the other big players in our markets, and I think they're saying the same thing. So I think we're going to see some rate increases sometime in the next 2 years, and I think the health care bill may be the catalyst that really turns the market.
Great. Tim, you're saying kind of slightly negative to flat-ish pricing you're seeing. Frank, I don't know, are you in your book, same
yeah.
kind of situation,
same
slightly
story.
Negative to flat?
Yeah.
Okay. Vic, could you, anything to add? Sorry about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting market. The as one reads about the larger property and casualty industry, and we're operating in one sector, it doesn't seem to be as price sensitive as other markets are right now. It differs state to state, but overall we're writing our renewing business is 2% less, or at the end of the year was 2% less than the prior year. And as you look through the companies, whether they be the publics or the mutuals or whatever, you're seeing folks with very high retention rates. So the business really isn't moving around much. There hasn't been really any significant change in the landscape of players. The folks that are doing the business in the medical professional segment are largely the same that they have been prior to going into the softer market. So the market's certainly soft, and it's certainly competitive, and our marketing folks are always beating their heads against the wall. But when you look at the aggregate data, there's not a lot of movement and there's not a lot of price decline. Now, there's certainly very little price increases. In certain segments, like our podiatry business, we're able to, because of the needs on that particular piece of the market, we're able to do some increased pricing in certain states. But it's tough generally to increase prices now. And one can argue that the data doesn't demand it. There has been falling frequency over time. It's, in our view, probably leveled off, or at least certainly we're seeing it in our states. What we, you know, one doesn't know on a global basis for a while. But severity always marches up. Severity has not changed over time. It's been moderate, but probably follows the cost of living for medical, the medical component of the cost of living. So it marches up at a slow but steady rate. So over time, the product doesn't become less expensive, but because of the declining frequency, it's been less expensive over the short term of the last 5 years.
And then, John, and just maybe just to kind of segue into the next one, if you could hit that one as well, but also talk about, I mean, this is a pocket of P&C insurance, Vic alluded to, is relatively insulated from the P&C industry overall. There aren't a lot of writers of lots of lines of business that also write this line of business, at least in kind of opposite the companies on this panel. Can you just talk about, again, rate and also any sort of change in the competitive landscape, new entrants, mm-hmm. capital, and how you see that, you know, potentially playing out if rates do rise here before they do in other lines of business?
Sure. In terms of rates, like everybody on the panel, over the last several years up until the most recent, rates have generally trended down some because frequency is near historic lows. It's been near historic lows, starting down in, for us, late 2003 and continuing near historic lows. We've had very little severity trends, certainly in our largest market as well. I think we're affected positively there because we have very low policy limits there, which puts an upward amount on the severity. So we're doing pretty well on both of those fronts. In terms of rates this year, they really have leveled out for us. In our Florida market, we had no change in our rates for the year. We kept them level with the prior year. And that's justified from the data that we're seeing. Now, I'm talking about our physician book there. I do think established players in this line can get rates increases ultimately if they're needed. Because the purchasers, certainly that are purchasing from the established companies, are looking more than just price. They're looking at they're looking for who's going to defend their claim, and that claim is probably one of the biggest things in their life when it happens. So I think you can get rate. We took our dental rates up, for example, in Florida 10% for the year. So I think you can get rate, certainly with the established companies and even with a lot of competition. Competitively, as you alluded to, we really haven't seen a substantial amount of additional capital move into this sector, even though the performance of the sector has been very good. There's been a lot of capital generated by the sector because it's been profitable, but not new capital coming in. I think that's because it's very much a niche business. It requires a substantial amount of state-by-state expertise. And so other areas in the insurance sector where, for example, hospital business, where you have much larger premium volumes, are more attractive to the big commercial carriers. There have been a lot of startups come into the business over the last 5 or 6 years, but with a few exceptions, like Missouri, where we're both in, Missouri, the startups have basically taken the market. In most states, like our primary state of Florida, while we have 6 or 7 startups, they really haven't affected us. Our retention's very high, and we've continued to grow. I don't see that changing. Ultimately, I think the startups will run into difficulties. I think the great claims trends have assisted them there and keeping them around longer than most of us thought they'd be. Ultimately, though, I don't think their expense ratios make sense, and I certainly know their pricing doesn't make sense. So at some point in the future, you'll start to see stress on those, and we'll see where that works out. I'm not sure that's going to happen in the next year, though. So generally, I think you're going to, it's very competitive. It's going to continue competitive, but I'm not seeing, or I don't believe you're going to see substantial new capital move in as such as a new player.
Great, thanks. And then I guess to Frank, with a slight wrinkle as well, I mean, can you talk a little bit about the status of reform in your kind of footprint? Has there been any change in reform that would cause you to modify your strategy in any of those states? And if not, if so, which? And if not, which states do you believe are the most reform vulnerable?
Okay. Well, the one that has gotten the most attention is Illinois, that their tort reform was overturned, declared unconstitutional, and that really was not a surprise. I believe it's the third time that they've had tort reform overturned and declared unconstitutional. And so when that came into effect 3-4 years ago, we really didn't adjust our strategy. We, you know, didn't lower prices. We just maintained our underwriting discipline, our claims management strategy. And so the fact that it's overturned now really wasn't a surprise, and may actually help us from the standpoint of some other companies may now need to raise their rates. And we have seen one of the startups in Illinois run into the very issues that John mentioned as far as inappropriate pricing and expenses that just weren't sustainable. So it's kind of helped us there. As far as the, you know, our other states, I don't think any of them are more vulnerable than the others. You just see that kind of constant, you know, chipping away. But for the most part, Ohio has been relatively stable now for the last 3 years or so. Michigan's tort reform has been in place since the mid-90s. And then New Mexico has their patient compensation fund. You do hear different discussions as far as maybe adjusting the limits there. But again, for the most part, it's just chipping away as opposed to any smashing of tort reform.
Great. Thank you. And then, Tim, I guess same sort of question, but maybe if you could talk a little bit about trends in Texas. And, you know, Texas is, as you said, a good place to write medical professional liability business. Do you expect, you know, a year from now, more capital to enter this market? And how do you? Are there barriers to entry in Texas that make it potentially maybe more difficult? And just generally, like, what keeps other carriers from disrupting pricing in Texas?
Yeah, well, we had new private companies enter the market right after tort reform. I think it's and they were price-based sellers that captured some of the price-driven part of the market. I think now with the situation about to turn, we're not going to see startups or new companies come into our state in a big way. It's difficult to enter our state. The top three companies have been there a long, long time. Two of us are not regulated. The other is a Berkshire company that's highly rated. And so I think that the only way to get into our state in a significant way is through price. And most people in this business know that that's not the right way to not the right way to do it. So I don't see that new capital coming into the state as a result of those factors.
And why is it that it's difficult to? Is it because of the entrenched distribution?
I mean, you've got two unregulated carriers that have a lot of nimbleness in terms of how they structure their products and just have the competitive advantage to be able to price every policy differently and structure every policy differently. So you've got long-standing players. The Medical Protect has been there over 100 years. We've been there 35 years. TMLT's been there 30 years. And so, you've just got some real sticky business with those top three carriers. And I don't think anybody's going to be able to bust through that other than through price. One of the things we always keep our eye on, and I think everybody here probably does, is the big hospital insurers and whether they try to go into this line more aggressively and insuring doctors. That has not been the case. In fact, St. Paul exited the state some years ago and created a lot of the turmoil that led to the tort reforms.
Great, thanks. And then does anybody? John, do you have a comment or follow-up? I couldn't tell. No? Okay. So let me go back to Vic, just to kind of circle back here. As far as ProSurance, maybe same sort of conversation, but maybe talk a little bit as well about, ProSurance is the only company of the group that's kind of moved away from that core physician demographic through acquisition activity. Can you talk a little bit about how you think about future M&A activity? Do you expect that you'll continue to add to your lawyer's book or potentially move further into ancillary care through M&A activity, or do you expect it, however many years from now, that ProSurance will still predominantly be a physician-based medical professional liability company?
Yeah. Well, of course, it's always somewhat difficult to predict the future, but we start with what are our core skills, and our core skills are medical professional liability based around physician practices. So to the extent that market remains viable and there are opportunities for M&A in there, we certainly want to be part of those. At the same time, as I said earlier, with healthcare reform coming down the road, insurance reform coming down the road, there's going to be a much, we feel, both more opportunities in the hospital going upmarket sector as well, where physicians are going as employees, and in the ancillary sector where just plain to meet the demand, you're going to need more ancillary healthcare providers online, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, that sort of thing. So we're looking at our core skill base and our capital base and looking to, as opportunities present themselves, move into those areas. We do have a lawyer's line. It's a small line, but we would certainly be open to expanding that as opportunities presented themselves. The professional liability skills are similar, not exactly the same, but are similar. We don't see ourselves becoming a general market insurance company down the road, but we do certainly look to be a broader specialist insurance company down the road.
Were you next? Did we start with you, John? This is the last time.
No.
Yeah.
I must be giving great answers.
Yeah.
You can't remember. Yeah, I answered that.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
No, I'm teasing. our view is we'll write medical professional liability and what I call logical extensions of that. That our management services initiative, where we provide essentially and usually on a fee basis, services to self-insured and alternative arrangements. As Vic said, as things happen with health care reform and doctors perhaps either partner up in different ways, including being employed by hospitals, we'll look to how to service that market. Certainly the hospital market itself, the premium levels and the amount of capital required to operate in that market is substantially larger than certainly most of us here have. But that doesn't mean that there aren't ways that you would partner up and provide services or reinsure out some of those risks. So we'll look to those sorts of things. But by and large, it's medical professional liability and logical extensions are is where our expertise is and where we'll intend to continue to play.
Great, thanks. And then just we have just a couple more minutes here, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about a topic we wrote about recently, just investment portfolios. And, you know, maybe if you could talk a little bit about risk selection, you know, how you think about how to orient your portfolio, and, you know, how, particularly in your municipal portfolio, how you think about risk selection there. And I think we'll start with Tim.
Yeah, well, we're probably a little bit of an outlier in this group in that we're not big into municipals, and part of that's just a historical phenomenon that because our insurance operation was managed by us prior to 2007 when we merged it in, it had cash flow issues that didn't have access to capital. So we had a lot of mortgage-backed products that generated a lot of cash flow. As we've rebalanced the portfolio, then the market got bad, and so we've been rebalancing into high-quality corporates. We only have 13% of our portfolio in munis. Almost all of that is in Texas general obligation-type bonds, Texas school districts, which are separately guaranteed by the state. And so, you know, we recognize the need to get a bigger footprint in munis over time, but we haven't bought any in the last 2 years because of the issues that you've been writing about and our concerns about, you know, whether the economy is going to spill over to municipalities.
Alvick?
Yeah, it's interesting as one manages a company over a long horizon, and I've been doing this in different capacities since 1985, different issues become predominant. I mean, generally speaking, when you have run a property and casualty insurance company of this type, you're a fixed income investor, high-grade fixed income. You know, you hire some outside managers that are good, and you look to get a few basis points better than your benchmark, and that's the end of the story. And you have your investment meetings every quarter, and you argue about whether you should go more into equities and decide you shouldn't, and you repeat that exercise over and over and over. Well, now, of course, it's a major challenge of running these companies. Where do you get enough yield to meet your income demands and look out at what's available in the marketplace? And it becomes a real balance exercise. We certainly have a significant amount of munis, 38% of our portfolio, but that's down quite a bit over the last couple of years as we've been scaling back. But they do provide good yield. We diversify those across states. We diversify them between general obligations and revenue bonds. And as one looks down the road, it's hard to predict what the next sector is going to be that comes under stress. So we do have a mixture of corporates, munis, some governments, TIPS. We have a substantial TIPS portfolio on looking forward to inflation down the road. We have a substantial BOLI investment, which is taking advantage of some of the life insurance mechanisms that are available that banks use traditionally. So we would suggest to you that it's just hard to predict. We've been very careful over time with munis. We've never relied on it. Long before it was fashionable, we've never relied on muni insurance. We always had our managers look to the underwriting, the underlying quality of those bonds, try to do their own underwriting of that risk rather than rely on the rating agencies. But the investment part of running a property and casualty insurance company has certainly, over the last 2 years, become much more of management focused than it has been traditionally.
Great, and we have just under 2 minutes here for John and Frank. So just
we look to maintain a high quality, well diversified portfolio. We do include a municipal allocation within that. I think if they're carefully selected, we use outside professional managers. We use other professionals to even assist us with that, and we do a lot of work internally. And with careful selection and with diversification, we're comfortable having a muni allocation in the 40 percentile range as well. So we do have those in our portfolio. We're comfortable with them. We look at them very carefully, and on a case-by-case basis, they work well for us.
Likewise for us. We manage the portfolio internally. We have two dedicated, very experienced individuals. Munis are a big portion of our portfolio. A good chunk of those are pre-refunded, but we just pick them very carefully. We look for essential purpose bonds. We stay away from certain geographic areas, and like Vic highlighted, again, we look to the underlying credit quality and don't rely on the insurance at all.
Great.
All right. Well, that wraps up our medical professional liability panel. I want to thank all the panelists here for participating, and we're going to take a short break. Thanks.